it's one thing to win a war for independence. Well, it's quite another to set up a new country with its web of laws, legislatures, courts, military, finances, taxes, and citizens. You're listening to The Classical Roots of Religious Liberty from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm Director of Distance Learning, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Arguing about the Constitution is a perennial American political pastime, and the arguments began within days after Congress sent the document to the states for ratification in late September 1787. In those days, as the Federalists debated the Anti-Federalists in one newspaper column after another, not a column was signed by the actual author. Instead, the authors took pseudonyms, and while those included Federal Farmer, most strikingly the names assumed were from the greats of the Roman Republic, Publius on one side, with Brutus and Cato on the other. The debate over the Constitution, then, was not merely a political debate, but an argument over history and the lessons of history as to what makes a nation thrive and prosper. In this fourth lecture, I explore dueling founders, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. I want to begin by talking about life in the United States after the War for Independence. It was the lumps and bumps of that life after the Revolution that brought about a Constitution to replace the Articles of Confederation and put the Federalist-Anti-Federalist debate into high gear. Second, we'll look at what the so-called Federalists believe and what they wanted. Then we'll look at what the so-called Anti-Federalists believed and what they wanted. And finally, I want to touch on what I think we can learn from the debate and how we can apply it to politics today. So first, 1781 and all that. October 19th, 1781, British General Charles Cornwallis surrenders to George Washington at Yorktown. The War for Independence is over. We won. American troops and British troops can go home, and life in the 13 no longer colonies but states can get back to normal. September 3rd, 1783, the Treaty of Paris was signed. The United States was completely free and independent of Great Britain, and as a bonus, we owned all the land from the Atlantic seaboard to the Mississippi River. Isn't that great? Well, yes, and no. It's one thing for a nation to achieve independence. It's quite another to have to govern that nation once you're on your own. Examples from Africa, the Middle East, Central and South America, and the Caribbean are legion. Always be careful of what you wish for. During the Revolutionary War, governing America was a catch-as-catch-can thing. It was ad hoc. Congress did its best under the Articles of Confederation to raise an army, pay an army, and conduct foreign policy. And with enough scrambling, it came out okay. Once the war was over, however, a whole host of problems remained. The biggest problem was that Congress, the one and only part of what was then called the general government, had precious little power. The vast bulk of power resided in the states. Congress could make laws, but had no authority to make the states obey those laws. For example, Congress could not impose taxes. Only the states could raise revenue through taxation and tariffs. What little revenue Congress had independent of the states was from the sale of land in the Northeast Territory that I'll get to in a moment. Otherwise, they had to ask the states for money. So the federal troops who won the war were never paid properly. Many took half salaries with the promise of deferred compensation. Congress promised support for disabled veterans and monies for other veterans, but Congress could only honor those obligations by asking the states for money. And here's the shocker. The states were not always interested in paying their fair share, and Congress had no means to make them fulfill their obligations. In 1793, a group of soldiers in Philadelphia, angry about pay and benefits, so threatened Congress that they had to move from Philadelphia for safety. By that time, the army, that was 11,000 during the war, had been cut to 625. No money, no army. War debts presented a similar problem. Since the war was expensive and disrupted the economy, Congress went into debt. Each state owed its share, but no one could make them pay. George Washington, in his 1793 retirement letter, wrote to each state's governor that if they didn't cough up some dough, quote, a national bankruptcy with all its deplorable consequences will take place before any different plan can possibly be proposed and adopted. So pressing are the present circumstances, and such is the alternative now offered to the states. And don't forget, 1793 was after the Constitution was ratified. In the Treaty of Paris, the British had ceded what was known as the Northwest Territory, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin. And Congress was selling land out there to raise money. But treaty or no treaty, British troops still occupied the Northwest Territory, and the British were profiting nicely from harvesting furs. Thus, settlers were faced with the British and with hostile Indians egged on and armed by British. And it's no secret that those troops were waiting for the United States to collapse into conflict and chaos so the British could march in and take over again. If you're raising money by selling land, this is all very bad news, and the general government's hands were tied. On the other side, states were seizing the property of those who were loyal to Great Britain during the Revolution. That was indirect and knowing violation of the Treaty of Paris. Congress could say they were very, very, very naughty, but that was about it. Congress had no ability to stop the states from violating the treaty. 7 of the 13 states issued their own currency, creating all sorts of problems with interstate commerce, foreign trade, and inflation. States began what amounted to trade wars with each other, imposing duties on goods from just across the river and arguing about borders. Again, Congress could make suggestions, but couldn't compel action. Then in 1786, Daniel Shays, who had been a captain in the Continental Army, led a rebellion against Massachusetts. Massachusetts, even in the 1780s, was Taxachusetts. Shays and 4,000 followers raided the armory at Springfield with the intent of seizing sufficient weapons to overthrow the state government. Well, they didn't take the armory, but Massachusetts couldn't put down the rebellion, and the general government had no ability to help. And that rebellion and its attending problems echoed across the states, and people were terrified. In the 1780s, people talked about the states as independent republics, and the threat of secession was very real. New England, Mid-Atlantic, the South, the lands west of the Appalachians could have become four or more separate nations. Something needed to be done. And in May 1787, the Philadelphia Convention opened with the idea of revising and amending the Articles of Confederation. And while everybody at the convention had complaints and thoughts, James Madison, who was sick of what he called the unwise and wicked proceedings of the states, James Madison had a plan, the Virginia Plan, that became the U.S. Constitution. And that brings us to the so-called Federalists. Now, you've been wondering why I said so-called Federalists. Well, it's a little confusing. Historically, a Federalist approach to government stands in opposition to a national or consolidated approach. National governments are centralized, consolidated, often one-size-fits-all affairs. China today is an obvious example. Beijing speaks, and everyone obeys. Federal governments, by contrast, are decentralized. They reflect the Catholic notion of subsidiarity, of pushing decision-making down to the lowest level that can competently decide. And lest I leave the impression that it's a Catholic idea, Presbyterian churches, even in the 1700s, ran on the same principles, push decision-making down to the lowest level. Thus, if a township is competent to make a decision, the county keeps out of the township's business. If a state can competently make decision, the national government keeps out of the state's business, and so on. The Articles of Confederation was a Federalist document. The general government, that is, Congress and nothing else, had limited power to perform certain specified or enumerated tasks. Each state had one representative in Congress, thus making each state equal regardless of population and amendments to the Articles of Confederation required the unanimous consent of the state legislatures. This was federalism as traditionally understood. Federalism is government from the bottom up. National or consolidated government is more top-down. Decisions are made at the highest levels, and those decisions are then binding on the states, counties, townships, families, and individuals. That's how federalist is traditionally understood, and we use it that way today, right? Federalism has something to do with states' rights and local decision-making, and is not about what goes on in Washington, D.C. In the Federalist-Anti-Federalist debate over the ratification of the Constitution, however, Federalists made something slightly different. And this is a great example of the politics of naming, naming yourself and naming your opponents. In the 1780s, Federalists were hardly top-down nationalists working on the next five-year plan, but they were a group wanting, let's call it as they did, a firmer general government. That is, a national government that had some teeth, that exercised authority over the states. The problems I listed earlier, they believed, required a firm solution from above, or the American experiment would soon become the late American experiment. The Federalists included James Madison, John Jay, and Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton's big issue was a secure and honest currency, since you can't have a successful economy without it. Those three, Madison, Jay, and Hamilton, authored the Federalist Papers, but there were others, including George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and John Marshall. Lynn Cheney, in her book, James Madison, A Life Reconsidered, writes concerning Madison's position, quote, "He had seen states pass laws that made it impossible for creditors to collect what was owed to them, and that violated international treaties. He had seen them try to legislate religious belief and refuse to pay requisitions, even when it meant that soldiers in the field went hungry. He had also seen that respect, neither for the general good nor for religion, had the power to prevent actions of self-interested majorities in the states. Thus, his conviction that a national veto was necessary, and his doubt that a constitution without it would work." Close quote. Without a central firm government, Madison and the others believed the Republic was doomed by the kind of bad decisions the states would surely make, were already making. The Constitution provided the solution, so you need to ratify the Constitution, they said. Yes, if you ratify the Constitution, states will have to give up some power and privilege. But as Madison wrote in Federalist 45, "But if the Union, as has been shown, be essential to the security of the people of America against foreign danger, if it be essential to their security against contentions and wars among the different states, if it be essential to guard them against those violent and oppressive factions which embitter the blessings of liberty, and against those military establishments which must gradually poison the very fountain," I suspect Shays' Rebellion was on his mind, "if, in a word, the Union be essential to the happiness of the American people, is it not preposterous to urge as an objection to the government, without which the objects of the Union cannot be attained, that such a government may derogate from the importance of the governments of the individual states? Was then the American Revolution effected? Was the American Confederacy formed? Was the precious blood of thousands spilt and the hard-earned substance of millions lavished? Not that the people of America should enjoy peace, liberty, and safety, but that the government of the individual states, that particular municipal establishments, might enjoy a certain extent of power and be arrayed with certain dignities and attributes of sovereignty?" Madison and his compatriots saw the state governments, not the national government, as the threat to peace, prosperity, liberty, and happiness. The Federalists frankly admitted that their idea of good and effective government was only partially federal. It was also partially national. Madison wrote in Federalist 39, "The proposed Constitution, therefore, even when tested by the rules laid down by its antagonists, is in strictness neither a national nor a federal constitution, but a composition of both. In its foundation, it is federal, not national. What he meant by that is the people, state by state, had to ratify it, not the state legislatures. In its sources, from which ordinary powers of the government are drawn, it is partly federal and partly national. That is, the House belonged to the people, which is national, and the Senate belonged to the states and was federal. He went on, in the operation of these powers, it is national, not federal. That is, the national law is the law and trumps state law. In the extent of them, again, it is federal, not national. The national government has limited scope. And finally, in the authoritative mode of introducing amendments, it is neither wholly federal nor wholly national. Now, as to this theory, even anti-federalist Richard Henry Lee, writing under the pseudonym Federal Farmer, agreed. I am fully satisfied that partial consolidation is the only one we can with safety and propriety proceed on. Making this the standard to point out, with candor and fairness, the parts of the new Constitution which appear to me improper is my object. The Convention appears to have proposed the partial consolidation evidently with a view to collect all powers ultimately in the United States into one entire government. And from its view in this respect, and from the tenacity of the small states to have an equal vote in the Senate, probably originate the greatest defect in the proposed plan. Close quote. Now, while that brings us to the anti-federalists, let me, before going on, look at another way to understand the federalists. This is a course on the classical roots of American liberty, so we should not ignore the pseudonym used by Madison, Hamilton, and Jay, Publius. Unlike all educated people during the founding era, I never read the history of Rome, and for years I had no idea what Publius meant. Was it here's to the public, or for the public good, or something like that? Well, you may already know that Publius is not a what. Publius is a who. Publius Valerius was one of the key figures in the rebellion against the Roman monarchy back in 509 BC. The Tarquin kings were tyrants, and Publius helped organize their overthrow and the establishment of the Roman Republic. No longer would Rome be ruled by changeable, evil, easily influenced rulers, but by law, which, wrote the Roman historian Livy, was impersonal and inexorable. Law has no ears. Regardless of Publius's role in ousting the kings, people accused him of wanting to be a king. He was, after all, one of several consuls, but after the war, he was the only one surviving, and apparently in no hurry, it seemed to them, to appoint new consuls. In addition to that, as a rich man, he was building a house on one of the hills overlooking Rome, a house that some said would make a dandy fortress for a king. Publius Valerius called the people together and had his men lower their fasces, that is, the symbol of the consul's power, thereby admitting that power was vested in the people. Now, remember, in all this, this is the character, this is the person from history that Madison, Jay, and Hamilton wanted their readers to keep in mind. Publius Valerius addressed the crowd. How could I, the bitterest enemy of monarchy, ever have believed that I should face a charge of coveting a throne? As to his house, he said, I'll build my house on the level. No more. I'll build it at the very base of the hill so that you can live above me and keep a wary eye on the fellow citizen you mistrust. He then proposed a right of appeal to the people of any decision of the magistrate, and, quote, the loss of all civic rights for anyone convicted of plotting for the return of the monarchy, close quote. As a result, Publius Valerius earned the title Publicola, the people's friend. Rome formed a republic, implied the Federalists. We are forming a republic. Our model is Publius Valerius, who was so beloved and who so hated tyranny that he was called Publicola. Okay, now on to the so-called Anti-Federalists. Again, the nomenclature is confusing. The Anti-Federalists were, based on the traditional definition, more Federalist than the Federalists. They had, as one source put it, a commitment to local government, to limited general government, frequent elections and rotation in office, and to writing things down because our liberties are safer as a result. Again, it must be stressed that these folks did not choose to be known as anti-federalists or anti-anything else. They would have preferred Democratic Republicans or Federal Republicans. Nonetheless, they were unfortunately tagged with the anti-moniker, which, needless to say, did not help their cause, particularly given that it was anti-accurate. Now, the Federalists, going back to the party language of the 1780s, were largely of one mind. The Anti-Federalists formed a spectrum. Some of the Anti-Federalists were part of the Constitutional Convention that framed the Constitution. As a bloc, they blocked some of the more nationalistic proposals that came up. And so states maintained lots of control. For example, the Constitution, as originally written, had state legislatures, not popular vote, choose senators. The people only voted for members of the House. Amending the Constitution was exceedingly difficult, requiring 2/3 of the House, 2/3 of the Senate, and a full 3/4 of the state legislatures. That's very Federalist. Anti-Federalists who helped frame the Constitution, men such as Roger Sherman and Oliver Ellsworth, both from Connecticut, believed they had done the necessary work to secure state power and individual liberty. They supported ratifying the Constitution. A second group of Anti-Federalists comprised those who believed the Constitution was probably dangerous to the people and to liberty. Richard Henry Lee was in that category. "It appears to be a plan retaining some federal features," Lee wrote, "but to be the first important step and to aim strongly at one consolidated government of the United States. It leaves the powers of government and the representation of the people so unnaturally divided between the general and state governments that the operations of our system must be very uncertain. The Constitution we're being asked to ratify," he argued, "is potentially, even probably, a problem. Don't risk the future by ratification." Then there was the group of Anti-Federalists that didn't think there was a potential problem. They were dead certain that the Constitution was the fast track to tyranny. Patrick Henry, Luther Martin, and George Mason were of this mind. George Mason wrote, "This government will commence in a moderate aristocracy. It is at present impossible to foresee whether it will, in its operation, produce a monarchy or a corrupt, oppressive aristocracy. It will most probably vibrate some years between the two, and then terminate in one or the other." Patrick Henry decried the whole Constitution based on the first three words, "We the people." "Have they said we the states?" Henry asked at the Virginia Ratification Convention. "Have they made a proposal of a compact between states? If they had, this would be a confederation. It is otherwise most clearly a consolidated government. The question turns, sir, on that poor little thing, the expression, we the people, instead of the states of America." He went on, "This Constitution is said to have beautiful features, but when I come to examine those features, sir, they appear to me horribly frightful. Among other deformities, it has an awful squinting. It squints toward monarchy, and does not this raise indignation in the breast of every true American." Wow. Samuel Bryant, writing as Sentinel, objected to the Constitution, since giving Congress the power to tax, to maintain a standing army in peacetime, and control over commerce would destroy the states, and with the states would destroy liberty. "If the United States are to be melted down into one empire," Federalists use the word empire as a good thing, anti-federalists as a bad thing. It becomes you to consider whether such a government, however constructed, would be eligible in so extending a territory, and whether it would be practicable, consistent with freedom. It is the opinion of the greatest writers that a very extensive country cannot be governed on a democratical principle on any other plan than a confederation of a number of small republics, possessing all the power of internal government, but united in the management of their foreign and general concerns. The author, calling himself Brutus, who may have been Abraham Yates of New York, argued that the national government, having the power to tax, would quickly eat up all the available revenue and leave nothing to the states. The legislature of the United States will have a right to exhaust every source of revenue in every state and to annul all laws of the states which may stand in the way of effecting it. Unless, therefore, we can suppose the state governments can exist without money to support the officers who execute them, we must conclude that they will exist no longer than the general legislature choose they should. Indeed, the idea of any government existing, in any respect, as an independent one, without any means of support in their own hands, is an absurdity. If, therefore, this Constitution has in view what many of its framers and advocates say it has, to secure and guarantee to the separate states the exercise of certain powers of government, it certainly ought to have left in their hands some sources of revenue. Brutus seems to ignore the fact that even evil scheming politicians are capable of exercising some degree of prudence and self-restraint. Nonetheless, the idea of the national government raising taxes raised hackles and raised speculation that if you ratify the Constitution, we, or at least our children, are doomed to a despotic, unaccountable, rapacious national government. By contrast, the anti-federalists believed that state government was much, much closer to the people. And there's a lot to be said for that. State legislatures can know their people, listen to the people, and be easily harangued by the people. Wyoming State Senator Cale Case is a friend of mine. On Fridays, a group of us goes to his hotel for the Scotch Summit, and Cale is typically there. He's been a guest in our home. We greet each other on the streets of Lander, where I can stop him and tell him what I think. Congresswoman Liz Cheney, by contrast, has 600,000 constituents here in Wyoming. I have no doubt that she's a wonderful person, but I have never seen her, let alone met her. And if I wanted a meeting with her, I'd have assorted hoops to jump through, including stating a purpose for the meeting. Hanging out just to get to know one another would probably not be considered a legitimate purpose. And let me also say that when I lived and worked in Washington, D.C., I had good relationships with a number of congressmen and senators and their staffs, but none of them were from my state of Virginia. The anti-federalists would have said, "You nailed it. That's exactly what we were saying." And back then, there was one congressman for every 30,000 citizens. If that had continued, the Wyoming delegation in the House of Representatives would have been 20, and the House would have had 7,000 members today. Someone said that would make a very interesting reality TV show, but it would not be any kind of government at all. What else did the anti-federalists object to? While the Constitutional Convention in the state of Pennsylvania ratified the Constitution, the anti-federalist minority wrote a dissent, and they listed 14 points of contention. The Constitution, they said, is missing religious liberty protection, guaranteed trial by jury, protection of the rights of the accused in a capital crime, a ban on excessive bail, excessive fines, and cruel and unusual punishments, protection from warrants issued without sufficient evidence, a guaranteed right to freedom of speech, of writing, and publishing, the right to bear arms, a ban on a standing army, and a clear statement of keeping the military subordinate to civil powers, guaranteed hunting and fishing rights, freedom of states to impose taxes, provision to increase the size of the House of Representatives based on population increases, states' rights regarding state militias, and some guarantee, quote, that the sovereignty, freedom, and independence of the several states shall be retained, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this Constitution expressly delegated to the United States Congress assembled. Sufficient mechanisms to keep the powers of the branches of government separate, by which they meant really separate. Clear language about the relationship between treaty obligations and the existing laws of the United States, and sufficient restrictions on the federal judiciary. That's a long list, but it's the meat of the objections. You might be thinking, didn't the Bill of Rights take care of most of that? Well, it did. The anti-federalist argument that gained the most traction was the need for a Bill of Rights. People wanted a written guarantee of their rights as a bulwark against tyranny. And the Constitution would not have been ratified without the promise that as soon as the new Congress convened, it would amend the Constitution with a Bill of Rights. When people confronted Madison with the need for a Bill of Rights, he was aghast. And I think we see in his response a picture of the whole Federalist approach. Madison, while he was responsible for the Bill of Rights, was convinced that it was problematic and unnecessary. "Why in the world," asked Madison, "would you want a Bill of Rights?" "Well, we want to make sure we secure the freedom of the press." Madison would reply, "Does the Constitution say the national government is allowed to abridge the freedom of the press?" "Well, no." "Well, then the national government may not do so." For Madison, that was enough. Enumerated powers. Anything not enumerated is out of bounds. The various freedoms, religion, speech, assembly, press, jury trial, and so on, were, Madison believed, implicit in the text of the Constitution. Including a supplemental list was, he thought, downright dangerous. Some important rights might be unwittingly left out, and any list could easily be misinterpreted and abused. Such parchment barriers, as he called them, were easily breached by majorities and inadequate for describing the full range of human rights belonging to human beings. Madison and Thomas Jefferson exchanged letters about the issue. Jefferson was in France through this whole period. And Jefferson convinced him to reconsider his position in light of practical politics. If the Constitution did not include a Bill of Rights, it would not be ratified. The state legislatures and the people wanted to know specifically what the federal government could not do. The Bill of Rights gave them the list they wanted. Jefferson agreed there were dangers in the Bill of Rights, but wrote to Madison, "Half a loaf is better than no bread. If we cannot secure all our rights, let us secure what we can." And so a Bill of Rights was promised, and that swayed a sufficient number of anti-federalists to vote for ratification, probably also believing that half a loaf is better than no bread at all. Now, I mentioned that Abraham Yates, or possibly Melancton Smith, we're not sure, wrote using the pseudonym Brutus. There was another anti-federalist author, George Clinton, who called himself Cato. And again, we find ourselves back to Rome and classic roots. Now, where Publius Valerius lived at the beginning of the Roman Republic, around 509 BC, Marcus Junius Brutus and Marcus Porcius Cato lived at the Republic's end in around 44 BC. Brutus was friends with Julius Caesar, but as Caesar amassed more and more power, Brutus went so far as to fight a civil war against him. Well, he lost, and he received amnesty from Caesar. Then, when Caesar was named dictator in perpetuity, which was essentially emperor, Brutus became a central figure in the plot to assassinate Caesar in order to save the Republic from a centralized despotism. Again, people during the founding era knew this stuff. So on the Ides of March, that is March 15th, 44 BC, Brutus, with a group of other senators, stabbed Caesar to death in the Senate. Whether Brutus actually said, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always to tyrants, is a matter of debate, but it's what the anti-federalists had in mind as they criticized the Constitution. Cato similarly battled with Caesar's increasing power by opposing him in the Senate at every turn in order to preserve the Republic. Finally, Cato, unwilling to live in Rome under what he saw as the imperial tyranny of Caesar, killed himself. A martyr, many thought, for the pricelessness of freedom. Let's turn to lessons learned. With the Federalist Papers, Madison, Hamilton, and Jay planned and executed a journalistic tour de force. They were 100% behind the new Constitution and intended to see the thing ratified. New York was a key part of the ratification strategy, and New York needed convincing, so off they went to New York to engage the questions in a focused, organized, purposeful battle of words. The Federalist Papers were not an ad hoc project. In Federalist 1, Hamilton wrote, "After an unequivocal experience of the inefficiency of the subsisting federal government, you are called upon to deliberate on a new constitution for the United States of America. The subject speaks its own importance, comprehending in its consequences nothing less than the existence of the Union, the safety and welfare of the parts of which it is composed, the fate of an empire in many respects the most interesting in the world. It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country by their conduct and example to decide the important question, whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force." The Federalist Papers is a book and reads like a book, with one essay sliding nearly seamlessly into the next. The writing is certainly not devoid of appeals to emotion. The quote I just read from Hamilton is very emotional. At the same time, Madison, Hamilton, and Jay relied on rational arguments to make their points. All in all, it contains a very positive message. While anti-federalist writings have been collected into a single volume, they are not a book, and they do not read like a book. Why? Well, because a bunch of guys wrote newspaper op-ed columns on their own. They were not organized or coordinated. As a result, the anti-federalist articles are kind of repetitive. They exaggerate and tend to be negative. The central government will suck up every cent of available tax money. Really? Does anybody believe that? It's sophistry, not argumentation. And a number of the articles assume the worst of the framers of the Constitution. Well, they're saying one thing, we think the states are just great, while plotting another. We will destroy state government, impose a tyrannical national government, and rob you of your liberty, your happiness, and your money. That is, the anti-federalists tended to be negative. In addition to that, the Federalists knew what they wanted. They knew the Constitution wasn't perfect. Madison had his doubts, and Hamilton had even more doubts. But they seem to have had the same attitude as Benjamin Franklin, who on the last day of the Constitutional Convention said, "From such an assembly, sir, can a perfect production be expected? It therefore astounds me, sir, to find this system approaching so near to perfection as it does. And I think it will astonish our enemies, who are waiting with confidence to hear that our councils are confounded like those of the builders of Babel, and that our states are on the point of separation only to meet hereafter for the purpose of cutting one another's throats. Thus I consent, sir, to this Constitution, because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best. The opinions I have had of its errors I sacrifice to the public good." The Federalists wanted this document to guide the future of the Republic toward the vision of the good they had in mind. As I read the anti-Federalists, I'm pretty convinced that most of them did not know exactly what they wanted. Oh, they were certain of what they didn't want. They didn't want a national government that could tax, maintain a standing army, control commerce, and dictate to the states. They knew well and surely what they were against, and they were insightful in pointing out the faults in the Constitution, faults that, quite honestly, we're dealing with today. But what were they for? Some suggested going back to the drawing board to try again, but none of them actually went back to the drawing board. What would have happened in the debate had a group of anti-federalists created another constitution? Here's an alternative document that embodies our anti-federalist vision of how our republic should form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common good, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. But nobody did that. I once heard the late Senator Jack Kemp say, "You don't beat a thesis with an antithesis, you beat it with a better thesis." Well, this was his more refined way of expressing Vince Lombardi's famous truth about football. The best defense is a good offense. Developing and executing a better thesis, that is, having a solid offense, is long overdue. We need a winning vision. The Federalists understood this. They had a winning vision. The Anti-Federalists really didn't understand that. They had a vague vision. And let me suggest that back in the ancient Roman Empire, Publius Valerius understood this. He had a vision. Brutus and Cato did not. They just didn't want things to change. What do we want the future of America to look like? The answer is not obvious or easy to express. It requires serious thought, extended conversation, and it requires us to avoid nostalgia. But it's safe to say that just as they did in the 1780s, and I suspect around 509 BC and 44 BC, our fellow citizens rightly long for freedom, happy lives, prosperity, and community. Their pursuit of these in our era has produced instead bondage to urges, a compulsive search for amusement, and an abiding alienation from God, from self, and from others. And in fulfillment of the Anti-Federalists' and the Federalists' worst nightmares, they want an all-powerful, intrusive, invasive national government to make it all better. They've succumbed to what Alexis de Tocqueville called soft despotism. Would the United States be a better place if the Anti-Federalists won the day, if the Constitution had not been ratified? And if the Articles of Confederation, with a few amendments, remained the law of the land? I have no idea. I do know that we'd be living in a very different country, or more likely, countries. And I also know the truth of Proverbs 29:18 in the Old King James translation. Where there is no vision, the people perish. My major critique of the Anti-Federalists is that, as near as I can tell, they had no clear and compelling vision for the future of the United States. They needed one. We need one. And that, I believe, is one of the greatest lessons we can learn from the Federalist-Anti-Federalist debate over the ratification of the Constitution. Thank you.